Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, my name is Laura Tyson, and I am, well, I have the pleasure, really, of interviewing Magdalena. Now, I haven't asked you how you pronounce your last name.
So it's very tricky. My last name is pronounced as if there's an SH in there. And then two E's, so it's Yashil.
Okay.
And you know, it sounds very exotic, but in fact, it isn't at all. It means green in Turkish.
Green, that's very nice. Green.
So I'm Maggie Green.
Before we get started, I do want to thank the sponsor for this session, Strong Legacy Planning. There's some information that, if it's not flown off your seat, is on your seat. About strong legacy planning. It's retirement planning, works for women, works for small business owners, works for people who are serious about their retirement. I'm also supposed to say, but it's irrelevant in this setting, that if you have phones or pagers, turn them off, but there's so much ambient noise, I don't think you'll notice that. And then at the closing, we will have signing. Magdalena will be signing books just outside the tent.
Thank you.
So Maggie Green, I want to start with a few observations about Maggie. She is a brilliant woman. I think it's important to start with that. When you read the book and hear about her history, you know that she is brilliant. She is someone who has a bachelor's and a master's in engineering from Stanford. She came, a lovely story. She was applying to schools in the United States, didn't know which ones to apply to, applied to exactly three, the Illinois Institute of Technology, MIT, and Stanford. Ended up starting out at the Illinois Institute of Technology, realizing that wasn't the right place, and going to Stanford. So one of the world's premier universities. And look, she was doing engineering and computer science at a time when very few women made that choice. Very few women still make that choice. It's still the case that women are seriously underrepresented in the fields that are natural feeders for success in the technology industries. So an important thing about this is to be smart and to get a good degree. Magdalena's smarts and education gave her entree to Silicon Valley, where she excelled. She excelled based on her vision, her boldness, her confidence, her intelligence, her education. She's had an amazing career, very varied, varied. She has been an entrepreneur. She has been a consultant. She has worked at a big company. She worked in small companies. She founded companies. She is herself a venture capitalist. She has really worked in all aspects of the technology industry. Very, very interesting. She says she got her MBA by working for a big consulting firm. Now, I'm a dean of an MBA program, so I was hoping she might have gotten an MBA from a regular program, but I know what she means when she says she got it from a consulting firm. She has been a real visionary in high technology. She actually was one of the very first people, and I think she can talk about this, to recognize that the internet had commercial potential. That it could be commercialized for business use. The internet started out for personal, academic, and military and security use. It did not start out for personal, and it did not start out for commercial use. She worked side by side with Mark Benioff to develop a small startup. The small startup was called Salesforce. Nobody was willing in the venture capital community to give money to Salesforce. She became one of the first investors in Salesforce and was the founding board member of Salesforce. So I'm sure you'll want to hear about that. She has also started three successful electronic commerce companies, and I think she's working on a fourth right now, so we can hear about that. And then as a venture capitalist, she has funded, as an early investor, over 30 companies. And she's a founder of something called Broadway Angels. I knew about Broadway Angels before I knew about Maggie. An angel investment group composed of world-class investors and business executives, all of whom are women, all of whom are women, and most of whom have served as the only female partner or senior executive in the firms in which they worked. So these are all visionary women coming together to be angel investors. The book is wonderful. It draws on her experiences, the experiences of many of the women she has worked with. It's filled with insights. It's filled with heart. It's filled with candor. I plan on giving it, I've told her this, to my son and daughter-in-law, both of whom are very ambitious and successful young professionals, because of the wisdom and advice it contains. So we are all very honored to have with us one of the true visionaries of Silicon Valley, actually, and in addition, a female visionary. But really, it does not have to be about the female part of this. She is a visionary in that whole industry that we have seen evolve from the time she first worked at a big semiconductor firm to today, where she's an angel investor and in another startup. So let's just start with why you wrote the book. You have obviously a lot of things to do with your life. Why did you write the book, and who did you write it for?
So I normally am a very private person, and I usually work and keep to myself. I love to hike on weekends. I love to sail on weekends. Those are my two activities. And writing this book basically took exactly 1 year for me. And what it did is it took my weekends away, because that's when I worked during the week. So that was my only writing time. The reason why I was compelled to write this book, and I was going to write it no matter what, was because I was beginning to hear, and now I'm talking about late 2015, I was beginning to hear from young women that Silicon Valley was a horrible place for women, that there was actually no opportunity for women, and several of them were calling and telling me that they were going to just opt out of tech careers, and that they couldn't make partner in venture firms, that they couldn't get the top jobs in operating companies, that it was very much a male culture. And it was so disappointing for me to keep hearing this over and over again. And I thought to myself, well, okay, we're not statistically significant, but there are enough women that I know, including myself, who've actually had very fulfilling careers in Silicon Valley. And instead of harping on the negative, which we know exists and it is correct, let's just forget the statistics and in fact showcase the women who have been successful, and then have them tell their stories, the good and the bad, the easy and the hard, and so that, you know, the 20-somethings, the 30-somethings who are female, who are reading this book, can actually have, number one, some motivation, and number two, maybe some learnings that are bottled in the book that they can apply to their own lives. So I am delighted that the book today not only is read by women, but also read by men. Actually, more than 50% of the people who reach out to me on LinkedIn are men. And usually my first question is, why did you buy and read a book that's the title is Power Up, How Smart Women Win in the New Economy? And the answer is in two categories. Either they bought the book for a girlfriend, a wife, a daughter, and they started thumbing through it, and it was an easy read, and they started saying, oh, it applies to me too. It's entertaining. These stories are very pragmatic. So that's category number one. Category number two is men who either have a female boss or they have been put on a diversity panel in their workforce, or somehow they personally are really interested in the movement of diversity. So they felt and were motivated. They felt that they could benefit from reading this book. So that's a long answer to your short question, why did I write the book? I wrote the book because I wanted to have young women get motivated, and I got the extra bonus of having some men reading it and getting motivated as well.
So I mentioned that I was going to have my son and daughter-in-law, because I think both of them will read it. And again, these are 30-year-olds, and I think I was struck by the fact that what you were doing by sharing your experience is really to provide wisdom, advice, motivation, optimism to that age group
That was exactly the reason. And in addition, some real pragmatic, okay, this is how it worked for me. You know, just it might not always work, but at least here's one way you could go about it. You know, how could you get that raise? How could you get that promotion? How could you get the venture capitalist to actually fund you? So that was the motivation, and I'm very happy for the final result.
Fantastic. It's a great result. Let's go to the fact that you start a book about winning with talking about failure. And I have heard many times from people who are successful, particularly successful entrepreneurs, about the need to have courage to fail. So I wonder if you could sort of talk a little bit about that in your own career.
Thank you. Yes. No, it's very true that I start, the very first thing I say in the book is, in fact, you know, what really makes one successful is having the courage to fail. Now, why? Because if we don't have the courage to fail, if we are going to get devastated by our own failures, we're never actually really going to be able to take a risk. And in fact, if we allow our failures and our successes to define us, I think we're not going to have very happy careers. So we need to be able to separate ourselves from our failures as well as from our successes and say, hey, it's my career. I try different things. Some things work out and some things don't. But just because I fail doesn't mean I myself am a failure. It just means that that opportunity, that startup, that company, that consulting firm that I founded myself failed because of circumstances. But I'm not a failure. So having that separation and having the courage to fail and pick up the bags and move on, I think really has been the, you know, the secret of my life, because I always felt like I had nothing to lose. I could try something new, and if it didn't work, I'd try something else. That gives you great freedom.
That actually
is really an incredible feeling, and you have to believe it, though. You can't fake it. But I start the book for that very reason, with the courage to fail.
Mm-hmm. So in the industry that you have been in, taking risk is so important because there's so much uncertainty. Because you were actually in the process of designing new products, new services, new concepts. Who knew if they were going to succeed?
Exactly. You're always taking a chance. I mean, that's what Silicon Valley is, such an exciting place. It's such a, you know, place of opportunity because you're taking a chance, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But each time you fail, you actually become more valuable as an entrepreneur, as long as you're not a sour loser. If you're a sour loser, no one wants to fund you again. But if you basically can say, hey, this is what I distilled from it, and now I'm so much better because of it, and move on and have that really self-confidence to say, just because my company failed doesn't mean it's a reflection on me. In fact, there are certain circumstances and I can articulate why I failed. So that's how it went for me here in Silicon Valley. Now, I've done a lot of things, partly because I'm pretty old. I am, you know, I've had 3+ decades. And so don't sit there if you're a younger person and say, wow, how did she do all that? When you're my age, you will look at your career and say, oh, yes, I've done a lot of things too. So it's a good thing to have been around. Also, because I went to school here, I graduated and basically walked across the street and got a job. So my whole career has been in Silicon Valley. I never left because why would I? I'm having so much fun.
So let me ask a question about, there were some wonderful words that you used to describe yourself in the book. As I said, the book is written with amazing advice, amazing experience, but there's also a lot of heart in it, and there's a lot of candor in it. There's a lot of description of yourself, and I want to bring up some words. You just mentioned one of them, because you sort of talked about how you've always had the confidence to say, if something doesn't work, it's not because of me. I'm not going to let that affect my sense of self-worth, my self-esteem. I'm going to figure out what are the factors that led to that and then move on. That's very, very powerful. I don't think a lot of people can do that. I don't think so.
I think the alternative is really horrible, personally. So, you know, it's like, if I have a choice, I'm going to say, you know, the company failed, I didn't.
So basically, some of the other things you've said about yourself. You've said you're audacious. You've said you're unflappable. You've said you're able to accept criticism without sacrificing your self-esteem. Your first boss said you had a delicious F-U attitude, and you say that that's been a big success, a big asset in your success. You also say that credit is not usually given. It's taken, and therefore you need to ask for it. Yet you also, I learned a new word in your book. I love the word. The word humbitious, okay? Humbitious. Humbitious is a blend of humility and ambition. Humility and audaciousness. Humility and the ability to take credit, in fact, demand credit for what you've accomplished. So can you talk about some examples of when you use this wonderful combination of an FU attitude and ambitiousness
to be
successful?
Actually, it's not just FU. To give him full credit, my first boss coined the term delicious FU attitude. And let me tell you the story, why where that came from. But that was my nickname at my first job. So where did that come from?
Delicious FU.
Delicious FU. They used to say, there comes delicious FU. And, you know, I was 21 years old. I was a female in a semiconductor company.
Right.
Where it was
right.
Basically the only 21 female around.
Right.
And I liked my nickname. So let me tell you the story behind that nickname. In those days, when you designed semiconductors, you basically were given your cubicle and the functional requirements of the product, and then you set and you designed literally end gates and OR gates and how registers and how the electronics would flow through. And one of the things that you learn very early as a engineer is that your logic, that we basically measure everything according to our logic is very faulty. Everyone's logic is faulty. So as you design, you actually design in your own faulty logic. So the thing that is done is design reviews. So every so often, and in those days they weren't very often, it was like every 3 months, 4 months, the whole engineering design team gets together, your boss, the other bosses, they all come into a room, and one engineer presents their whole logic diagram, their whole logic of the semiconductor chip they're designing. And then they get comments, critiques, you know. In my case, this was my very first design review. I was incredibly proud of my work. And I came and put it all up. And it was a whole afternoon. It's probably 3 or 4 hours where you're standing up, you're defining exactly what you've designed, and you're getting feedback. In my case, the feedback was pretty brutal. I mean, I had a ton of mistakes. I realized, okay, you know, I'm really going back to the drawing board to redo a lot of this. And the good thing for me was that my fellow engineers were incredibly detailed. I mean, they were catching, you know, each one of my mistakes. They were criticizing me, not in the most, you know, not in the nicest way per se, but they were giving me great feedback. So after the meeting, my boss pulled me into his office. He says, "Come on in. How do you think that meeting went?" I said, "I think that meeting went very well." And he looked at me and he said, "Were we in the same meeting? How could you think that meeting went well?" I said, "Well, I think that meeting went very well because they actually really gave me good feedback. I mean, they caught all my mistakes. They caught my bugs. I now know exactly what to do. I'm going to go back and fix all of that." This was an incredibly productive meeting. And he was shocked. He said, "Wow. You really have a delicious FU attitude." And he said, "Where did that come from?" I'm like, "I don't know, but it was really, I think it was a good meeting." So anyway, that's the story. That's the genesis of that nickname. The combination of being humble and ambitious, mm-hmm. I think, is so key. And I can't take credit for that. That actually is a term that was originated at Bell Labs. They did a study of all of the different scientists and researchers looking for attributes that made them successful. And they found out that the scientists and researchers at Bell Labs who were the most successful shared these two attributes, humble and ambitious. Mm-hmm. The reason why that combination is so great is because if you are entitled, which is the opposite of humble, people basically don't want to help you because you walk in all entitled. People are like, hey, she thinks I owe her something because that's what entitlement is all about. Mm-hmm. And guess what? I'm not going to give it to her. The whole attitude from the other side is basically being off-put. Mm-hmm. Entitled attitude is an off-putting attitude. But a humble attitude, people actually really want to help. They want to extend. They want to appreciate your humbleness. Mm-hmm. But humbleness doesn't mean that you don't strive for the very top. And that's where the ambition comes in. The ambition basically says, no, I am humble, yes, but I am striving for the very top, for the very best I can be. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, going back as an immigrant, that has been a feature that I didn't necessarily work on it, but it came from coming to this country knowing that no one owed me anything. No one had to open a door for me. I had no friends, no relatives, no family. But every time I got a break, I was so thankful for it. And people saw that, and they were appreciative, and they opened doors for me.
Yeah, it's a wonderful concept, a wonderful story.
Thank you.
So you talk a lot about the importance of being the boss of your own career. And you also talk with some skepticism about mentors and some support of the concept of sponsors. So tell a little bit about how you've been the boss of your career and whether and how sponsors, maybe rather than mentors, have been helpful to you.
So the boss of your own career, it doesn't matter that you have a boss. The boss you have is the boss for your work at the moment, not the boss of your career. And for me, I wasn't that smart that I knew three steps or four steps ahead of where I wanted to be. I wasn't such a good strategist. But I knew where I wanted to be one step ahead. Okay. And I actually architected my moves accordingly. And what I did was, when I knew I wanted my next job and what it was going to be, I actually started doing that job long before anyone gave it to me because I wanted to prove to those around me that I had the capability. Sometimes I stepped on toes. There is no question about that. But I architected my career one step at a time, knowing exactly where I wanted to go and driving myself to it. And it did work out for me, and it's something that I do recommend. Now, let's talk about mentors and sponsors and even allies. I think that a lot of young people, especially young women, have been given this fairy godmother image of mentors. And in fact, they've been told every problem in your career is going to go away if you can just find a mentor, because that mentor is going to make introductions, right, open doors, and tell you exactly what to do. In fact, I think such mentors don't really exist. I mean, if they exist, they're very few and far between. And I do think that young people are being misled to think that someone else, not themselves, can aid with their career. The only person who can really move you forward is yourself. Now, certain folks can help, no question about it. And I draw the distinction between a mentor and a sponsor by saying that a sponsor is someone who's actually going to benefit from your success. It's a symbiotic relationship. Because, you know, let's face it, there are good people in the world, but there are not that many benevolent ones who just want you to succeed and want nothing in return. Usually, that's not the case. So a sponsor is someone who will benefit from your success. Let's say a boss is a great sponsor example, Because if you do well, hopefully your boss and your whole department is doing well. Someone also who can be a sponsor is in your more direct circle, not someone who is far out. So I feel that young people should look for good sponsors, not necessarily just mentors. And I think the very best sponsor you can have early in your career is a great boss. So if you don't have a great boss, start looking. And I also, you know, when people ask me which job they should take and they've got two or three offers, I say, don't take the job that pays you the most.
Right.
Don't take the job that is even in the best company. Take the job where you feel you're going to have the best boss. And I can't tell you how many times my bosses or my partners have made such amazing, mm-hmm. you know, sponsorship, you know, provided such amazing sponsorship for me. Why? Because if I was going to be successful, they were going to benefit, and they sure have. So anyway, that's the distinction I draw, and I do think that the concentration on mentors is overdone, and think of potential sponsors for yourself.
Yes, I think it's important to say that for a considerable period of time, say teaching in business schools or looking at research about what to do to promote gender equity in business, mentorship was a very powerful concept. And I do think now the evidence increasingly supports what you're saying, which is really what you need is an active sponsor. And that sometimes, you also say this in your book, a mentor can just be a friend. I mean, there are lots of, you could get
Absolutely.
Lots of good mentorship advice from your peers.
Absolutely, yes. And sometimes they're actually phenomenally good because they know exactly what you're going through because they might have just had a very similar situation.
Exactly. So let's turn to Salesforce because I'm sure everyone in the audience wants to know some of your early Salesforce stories. Just talk a little bit about, you really were a key part of the firm's birth and success. So just add a little color to that.
So people say, when did you get involved with Salesforce? And I say, I got involved with Salesforce day minus one.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no company. There was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just set the setting. Like, you know, how did this happen? So at my second company, which was CyberCash went public in 1996. I got to meet Mark Benioff. Mark worked at Oracle, and CyberCash and Oracle had a partnership that I had put together, and basically Mark Benioff was my counterpart at Oracle. So he is the guy that I worked with. He was promoting us at Oracle, and we had a very successful partnership. Mm-hmm. And when I left after CyberCash went public, I left and started my next startup, MarketPay. And Mark wanted to invest in MarketPay. And I sold it on month seven. I sold it very early, very prematurely. And so I told Mark, sorry, you know, sold the company. And yet our partnership and friendship continued. We looked at a couple of investments together. I became a venture capitalist because I didn't know what else to do with myself. And as a VC, I was looking at companies and, you know, I'd use Mark for diligence. We looked at stuff together. And in those days, now I'm talking about 1998, I was looking at the enterprise software space. And enterprise software, if you guys remember this far back, still was very expensive, you know, $1 million plus licenses. And then you spend another $1 million or $2 million in getting the software implemented in your company.
And years. I mean, I remember
exactly,
being
years.
On boards of big companies that were buying that stuff for millions of dollars. And then years would go by
so very
before
true.
They could implement it.
And that was the most frustrating
it
part
was so
for companies. Because,
so
you know, not only did you spend, like you said, millions of dollars, and then it took years to implement it, mm-hmm. to get it going. Mm-hmm. And then when it was all said and done, people used only about 20% of the functionality because it was like mammoth stuff. Like most people couldn't even learn all that additional functionality.
You had to have constant consultants working
exactly,
with you.
Exactly. There was a whole industry of integrators and then consultants. So if you remember the days, there was, you know, right around this time, this movement towards ASPs. So it was taking an application and providing it as a service, application service providers. So I'd been looking at this space and knew that enterprise software's days were numbered. I knew that this just couldn't go on because I listened to a lot of customers really complain as to how laborious and expensive the process was. So one day Mark called me and said, hey, let's have lunch at this one place. And he specifically wanted to meet there, even though it was inconvenience for me and inconvenience for him. But whatever, okay. We met and he shared this idea with me of taking Siebel Systems, which was the leading CRM enterprise software, and shrinking down only about 10% of its functionality into a basically a cloud based system. But we didn't know the word cloud then. We didn't have the word SaaS, you know. So he explains this stuff to me and he says, what do you think? Like, I'm thinking about this. Do you think this is a good idea? Do you think we can get funding? Do you think we can sell it? And right at that lunch, I said, Mark, I think this is a fantastic idea. This is exactly what I'm thinking. And the nice thing about CRM, the space you just, the vertical that you just defined for me, is that every company in the world has some sort of need for a, you know, basically a sales or a customer engagement tool. So yes, this is a fantastic idea. So right then and there, I committed to Mark to be his investor, to be his board member, to help him hire the engineering team. I mean, there was no company. It was just an idea for him. And I said, okay, so what do we do next? You know? And he said, well, I've been talking to these guys, these engineers, and I've had a tough time convincing them. Help me actually recruit them. And that's what we did that afternoon. And that's how the journey started. Mm-hmm. The journey started in a very optimistic way, and that was partly because it was the dot-com boom. It was very good times in Silicon Valley. Everyone and their brother was getting funded, and I thought, oh, I'm a venture capitalist. I mean, of course my firm is going to fund this, no problem. Well, unfortunately, that's not how it went. It turns out, even though Salesforce raised a lot of money, none of it came from venture capital. And not even one penny. So it wasn't always smooth sailing. There were multiple times where, it was almost Friday and we were worried about making payroll. And there was one time after the dot-com bust when most of our customers had died, because a lot of our customers were small companies early on, venture-funded companies. And when the dot-com bust happened, they started, you know, going away because VCs wouldn't continue funding them. There was a period where we had very high negative cash flow, meaning every month we were burning somewhere between $1 million to $1.5 million, but we couldn't fund funding. So we were basically driving against the wall. And my biggest, maybe not my biggest, but my most happy moment was when I could convince Mark that we should change our business model and move away from this pay monthly, which had been our mantra, to actually moving our customers to contracts, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year contracts, and asking them to pay up front. Because what would that do? I ran a spreadsheet and realized, hey, even if only 30% of our customers convert, this is cash coming into the company. Where if we give them a discount and get 1 year in advance, if we give them a bigger discount, get 3 years in advance, this is a way of getting the cash we need because the venture industry is not funding us. So Mark, after some real hesitation, because he'd been like out there saying, no software, no contracts, you know, but he realized that this was one way we could save ourselves. And also he realized that our salespeople were also of this mindset, meaning they weren't pushing back and saying, no, we're going to lose our customers if we ask them to sign contracts, but they were saying, we think we can do this, we think we can sell it. The customers loved the product so much that were willing to basically help us out. And about 6 months later, we were cash flow positive, About, I think, 50% of our customers signed up for these contracts, so the rest is history. Today, almost a $90 billion valuation company, so from humble beginnings.
I think what that story shows so many wonderful things about Maggie, but I want to say the combination of engineering prowess and business acumen, because that story about figuring out a new billing model in the middle of an internet collapse is worthy of textbook writing of excellent business acumen. Fabulous advice.
You know, it goes back to like, okay, I'm not going to fail, you know? I mean, it's just like, what do I do? And I had two little kids at the time. And I remember because I brought Salesforce to my firm, USVP, for a presentation. And
that's your venture capital firm.
Yeah, my venture capital firm. And my partners basically said, like, no, we are not going to invest. And all the more reason not to invest is that this company still calls themselves Salesforce.com. And they said, why don't you go back and tell Salesforce.com to drop the dot com from its name? Because haven't they heard that there's been a dot-com bust? And I went to Mark and I said, Mark, not only did they turn us down, but they told me to change our name. And Mark says, no way, we are Salesforce.com.
So I've already gotten a sign that we have 5 minutes more before we go to the audience. And I want to then shift a little bit to really another thing that's so in the news these days. And that is sexual dynamics in the workplace, Me Tooism. And I really want to get your sense, being a woman in an industry which has been predominantly a male industry, how you dealt with any sexual harassment you may have encountered in your career. And I want to ask this question saying that although I'm older than you, I'm also been around quite some time, and how you talked about this had very great resonance for me. But I really think it might have resonance for the audience as well, because we're deeply involved now in this discussion about how to change or affect sexual dynamics in the workplace. And you've obviously had to deal with some of that in your career.
I graduated. I actually started working before I graduated because I had no money. And the first time they told me I could start, I started. I was a young woman. I went and bought myself, I'll never forget, from Macy's, a pink cotton suit. Now, why would anybody wear a pink cotton suit to work? But I didn't know any better.
For the time,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, you know, I never forget it. It had like white piping, and I showed up very proper. And yes, I was the only woman, no question about it, who was a professional. You know, we had women, but they were administrative staff. And did I ever get sexually harassed? And my answer is no, I didn't. Now, I can tell you stories, and you might say, oh, Magdalena, that was sexual harassment.
Right.
And it might have been, but I didn't interpret it as such. Mm-hmm. And anytime I had innuendos, anytime someone was just flirting in that, you know, kind of middle zone, I basically did not engage. Right. I had the attitude of just ignoring them. Now, you have to remember, English is my fourth language. So when I first started working, most of the stuff that was being told, I didn't even get. Because I hadn't grown up in the United States. I didn't get the kind of, you know, the edgy jokes or whatever. So I didn't engage. I had this Dr. Spock look on my face and continued being polite. And you know what? There's nothing better than throwing cold water on someone's, you know, ulterior motives when you just look like that and don't engage. As time went on and I started figuring out what they were saying or where they were leading, I still acted the same way, and it still worked. So, you know, one of the things that I suggest is don't engage. The other thing I think is that I always, when I met a colleague, a male colleague or a female colleague, but it was mostly male, I always walked up with a ton of self-confidence. I always was the first one who extended my hand. I always looked straight in the eyes of whomever I was talking to and smiled. There was something in the way I presented myself that basically said, I have just as much power as you do, and I am your equal. And, you know, people, most people, not everybody, but most people, they get that vibe. They know. Mm-hmm. I went, when I was a semiconductor product manager, not a designer, I actually was sent on a one-month tour around the country in Canada, and I was presenting my product so that my product could be designed in to computer systems and telecommunication systems. Every single evening, I'd fly into a town, into a city. The local sales guy would pick me up, and it was always men. I never was picked up once by a woman. And then they would take me out to dinner, and sometimes they'd take me out to honky-tonks if it was Texas. And they tried to drink me under the table. And then the next morning at 7 a.m., it was time to, you know, meet for breakfast, and off I went at 8 a.m. to present my product. And this happened night after night after night, and I was totally comfortable with handling these men because, let's face it, most people don't want a straight-out no at them, and I navigated the waters. Now, when I say this, people say to me, ah, you are saying you weren't sexually harassed because of the way you conducted yourself. So the flip side of that is that if someone is sexually harassed, you are saying they didn't conduct themselves properly. And I'm not saying that, because in fact, you can't negate what I just said and draw a conclusion. What I'm saying is that in my life, in my personal career, the way I conducted myself worked out very well for me. It couldn't have always worked out. I'm lucky, because I really didn't deal with any ugly situations. And one last bit of advice. If you ever are uncomfortable and you feel that this is not right, you have to say something about it immediately. Don't delay it. Don't think it's going to go away. Don't think you're being rude or improper. You have to say something. And if the person that you say that to doesn't accept what you just said and continues, then the next step is either your boss or the HR office or potentially your attorney. But you have to say something. You can't let it go. But if it doesn't happen, we don't also have to read negativity into everything. So it's our judgment call, and I'm just a very lucky person because I do think that I had a great career in a men's world, and I didn't need to deal with the ugliness.
So I also feel the same way. That's your story had resonance for me because I'm an economist. There weren't that many economists doing what I was doing at the time I was doing it. I managed, I think, partly through oblivion, I think I would say, not understanding the language, to miss some cues, but that's a very safe thing to do. And I'm very blessed that I didn't actually have any incident that I had to call somebody out. But I agree with you completely. It has to be the case that young women have to understand that when that is the case, no matter what you do, you need to call it out and you need to act on it. So,
by the way, when the book came out, several men approached me and they were sexually harassed at the workplace. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. They just wanted to share those stories with me. So, you know, it happens. Right. It's not just a women's issue.
Nope.
It is a human issue and it's wrong and it needs to be called out.
Okay, one final question before I turn to the audience. I have many, many questions. I could talk to Maggie all night. There's a lot of discussion about the role of implicit biases in holding back diversity, whether it's gender diversity or diversity against African Americans or diversity in general. So you talk about implicit biases, but you also come out pretty strongly against the use of quotas to respond to such biases. And I wondered if you could talk about why you're opposed to quotas and what you think, in the absence of quotas, one can do. You have the concept of guardrails against biases. So what can be done to deal with biases?
Yeah, so thank you very much for asking that. It's very controversial My one of the co-founders of Broadway Angels feels very strongly about quotas, and I feel very strongly against quotas, and we work together. So, you know, there's difference in opinion on this topic. I feel very strongly against quotas for a very specific reason, and let me tell you why. In fact, when I was doing the research for this book, I went to a law firm, and the law firm had a top law firm in Silicon Valley, and they had put together informal quotas. They wanted to, they had gone to some really top law schools, and they wanted to bring more women into the law firm. So they had said, we're going to get 50% men, 50% women. Now, nothing's wrong with that, right? I mean, that actually makes sense. 50% of the population is female. Well, the negative side effect of that was that a lot of the senior partners knew about this, knew that these young women were being brought in specifically to make the numbers look good. And what ended up happening was when I interviewed the young women, what I was told by them is that they were brought into the law firm, but they were not getting the really exciting, the really challenging law cases, because the senior partners were saying, you know what, I don't know if she is as good as the other guys, because I think she was brought in a quota. And that was very, really horrible situation for the young women. In fact, listening to them argue against quotas made me even more convinced that this was not a good thing. So I do believe that diversity is a good thing for business, especially in tech, because we have had so many people who look just like everyone else in that company designing products for the general population. That just doesn't work. But the quotas, I don't think, is the right way to go about it. I think the right way to go about it is twofold. Number one, to actually expand the universe that we hire from. Because what we do is we just go, and I am guilty of this. We're all guilty of this. I'm in a hurry. I need that engineer tomorrow. I just go to my little circle, and I see who in my little circle is available. Well, guess what? My little circle went to the same school as I did, or similar schools. So we end up inbreeding, basically. Inbreeding is not a good thing. So I feel that, number one, just ensuring that we start with a big funnel. And at the end of the funnel, we hire whomever is the best candidate, regardless of all the other issues that we're trying to, you know, maximize for. We hire the best candidate. But if we start with a big funnel, I think it's going to make a big difference.
I think that, again, what I've observed in my lifetime is that gradually organizations are doing much better at broadening the funnel, at doing the search. So even the organizations that really are steering away from quotas, they have this notion, well, let's set a target and let's see what happens by searching. So basically there is, I think I encounter this frequently now because I sit on several boards and just the way board searches are done. So diversity becomes one of the priorities of board selection, but it's only one, and then you search differently. So I do think that's a very important distinction. So, and I think probably there's disagreement in this room, as there is among your partners.
Always.
Some people think there should be quotas. And
but that's
some,
diversity,
some
right? Disagreement is diversity.
Diversity,
so it's
of
good.
Opinions, right. So why don't I stop for some questions? I have more I could ask. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this book on, for example, the perennial question of balancing family and career. You've heard that Magdalena has two children. She has balanced a family life, a very rich family life, with a very rich career. But let's, before we turn to that, let's see if there are questions from the audience.
I have a really simple question. I run a business that I hire management companies. I have a lot of trouble, I'm from South Dakota, being Minnesota nice, saying, please, I would like to have this done maybe by next week. When I really mean, God damn it, I want it done yesterday. I don't know the in-between.
maybe the best way to communicate is to actually really clearly write it down. My expectation is tomorrow, and my expectation is under $500, and my expectation is, you know, you don't leave a mess at the end. And if you write things down, then your delivery doesn't matter, because what you just said is that your delivery, because you were brought up to be polite, is communicating a message in California that's not being picked up by those folks that you're working with. So one thing I've learned, I grew up in Europe, right? My parents used to say it doesn't matter what you do or how you do it as long as you are well-mannered doing it. Manners were very important when I was growing up. So I learned that if I write things down, I'm a clearer communicator than if I'm trying to say it in my way, which sometimes garbles it up.
That's great advice. That's really very good advice. You also, you know, when you were talking in the book about yourself, you said sometimes what you would do, you would invite... So critical things that were critical of what you were doing, which you turned around to be a learning experience, and then you would actually keep the evidence, you'd keep the email, so you could actually say, look at all the ways in which I have learned from the advice, criticism, expectations, and have moved forward from it. So again, keeping the record.
Exactly, and you know, people appreciate that, especially bosses. Like, I learned that if you show your boss the criticisms you got from your colleagues, most people don't want to do that, right? They want to put it under the rug, hide it. But if you can show the criticism you got and then say to your boss during your review, and these are the steps I took,
this is what I did,
to actually reply to that criticism. And today I don't do that I was criticized for 4 months ago. Wow. Like, that gets you great brownie points.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm involved in the tech industry and know that there's, if not an explicit, an implicit respect for engineers. And I have not read your book, but I'm wondering if you would, I'm wondering as you're speaking, and you've had some very impressive achievements, certainly, how much it would have been different if your background was not in engineering and technical background, because I think that could make a real difference in terms of how any person, regardless if they're a man or a woman, would be treated in the tech industry.
You're absolutely right. And I say over and over again that the best thing I ever did for my career was get a master's in electrical engineering.
That's right.
And I do think that my undergraduate degree, which was industrial engineering and engineering management, was too lightweight. I don't think I would have gotten that level of respect. But I walk into a room, any room, and when someone tries to snow me down, I ask them the questions without ever thinking it might be a stupid question. Because I feel like if they think I'm stupid, I'll say to them, hey, put me up against anybody else, and I can compete with them on the technical level. So that gives me, not only does that basically get me the respect of the other side, it also gives me the self-confidence. And I do think that's why I love engineering. I think it's a fantastic degree because it gives us that self-confidence that no one can snow me down with their questions or their comments.
So I want to say that the reason I emphasize at the beginning, I said a couple of things about Magdalena. One was she was really smart. I think it's important. This is a combination of someone who is really smart and has an advanced degree in engineering. And those two things are highly valued in Silicon Valley. They're highly valued in Silicon Valley. So then you take that combination of those two things and the incredible kind of personal sense of being a professional, of basically being able to see ahead in your career, so many things you've brought in addition to that. But I would say without those two things, it's pretty hard to say, well, the prospects for winning in the technology industry are much reduced if you don't have an engineering degree and if you're not smart, pretty damn smart at engineering, pretty damn smart at computer science. So That's just I agree with your question, and I think that Magdalena has basically indicated that it was the most, in a sense, it was the foundation. Nothing else could have happened without it. I mean, that was the beginning.
But that really begs me to tell the story. Thank you very much for your wonderful compliments. But talking about being smart, I have to share this story with you guys. So I am very dyslexic. I am very, very confused with my left and my right. And to this day, it's one of the hardest things for me to find my way. Mm-hmm. And even finding the stent, like I can solve anything. I can do spreadsheets. I can do all kinds of hard problems. Don't tell me to get from A to B. So the world thinks I'm smart. And I get hired as a venture capitalist. And because I'd taken two companies public that I founded, and, you know, it's like I have a good reputation. And they're bragging about me, and they're saying she's really smart, and we brought her in. So we're going on our offsite, my first offsite with them, and I don't really drink much. I get migraines from wine and stuff. So I'm like, hey, I'll be the designated driver for you. So, you know, I'll rent a van, and you guys can drink all you want. And they say, oh, we love her. You know, she's great. So I am driving. I get the van. All my partners are in the van, and I'm driving to our first dinner. And one guy is sitting next to me, and he's the navigator. And he says, okay, at the next corner, you turn left. And everyone's behind, and they're saying, turn left. And they're saying, turn left. And I'm saying, okay, I'm going to turn left. And then the corner, I stop, and then I turn right. And then they say, there's silence. And they say, why did you do that? And I say, do what? He said, why did you not turn left? And I said, I did. And then there was silence. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what to make of me. Here is this woman that they thought was so smart. I had just turned right, and I thought it was I turned left. And that was it. And then I said, why is everyone so quiet? And they said, Magdalena, you turned the wrong way. And I said, oh, I do that all the time.
Well, there are smarts and there are smarts. That's a great story. Some other questions?
I think we have time for one more.
One more?
Hi, Magdalena. I'm actually going to be a Salesforce employee in maybe like 2 weeks because I currently...
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I currently work at MuleSoft, so we're recently acquired by Salesforce.
MuleSoft is pretty good too.
Yeah, thanks. So one thing we're really looking forward to on the talent team is working with such an inclusive environment that Salesforce has built, like that's part of their branding. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you and Mark, having such a close partnership and you were there from foundation to post-IPO, were some of those discussions around inclusion and diversity like influenced by you? And I'd love to hear about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I was the chair of the comp committee at Salesforce when we founded a comp committee. And I, being a woman, really cared about, you know, I mean, listen, I just don't understand what's so hard about equal pay for equal work. I mean, it's just like, I don't care, man, woman, you know, race, religion, it's like equal pay for equal work. I think it's such a simple concept and it's so hard to execute. So I'm like, okay, I'm head of the comp committee now and I have a responsibility to make sure it's equal, right? Well, the problem for that was in the early days, even though we were not very small at that time, but there were so few women that statistically you couldn't take the averages because the averages didn't mean anything. Well, of course, the company is much bigger now, so when you've got 25,000 people, it's different than when you had 1,000 people or 2,000 people. And, you know, of those 2,000 people, the females in the sales organization had parity. But the females in the engineering organization were very hard to say if they had parity or not because they were very few, you know. But from day one, that was like if I was going to have anything to do with any company, I was going to fight for equal pay, for equal work, because it's so common sense, and it just causes so many problems when you don't do that. And it's shocking that, you know, fast forward 30 years of my career, and it's still a topic we talk about as if It's something we still have to work on. And believe me, we still have to work on. I am counting, and these are my parting words to you, I'm counting on the fact that just like we have outside auditors that audit our books, our financials for publicly traded companies, 10 years out, we're going to have outside auditors, or I hope we're going to have outside auditors that actually audit the pay discrepancies in corporations, in publicly traded corporations. We've got to do that.
And
thank you.
Salesforce, of course, is leading the way here in terms of its pay equity reviews. So you are going to a place which is well known to do the reviews. They're going to keep doing the reviews. They've set the standard for lots of other companies to do the reviews. And there now are some interesting outside organizations that are actually, I think your prediction, oh, don't worry about that, your prediction that we will have outside auditors. There are now, there's an organization in Switzerland, actually, that you know the LEED certification for business, for buildings, they will now do a certification for business on a whole set of business practices.
I love that.
Yeah, that's just an example of things we're going to see more and more of. So thank you, everyone. You'll love reading the book. Magdalena's going to be out there signing it. At the end of the book, she mentions that she has a no regrets strategy or attitude towards life. And I think we've all been infected by her enthusiasm and leadership. And certainly I have no regrets that I read the book. You will have no regrets that you read the book either. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being so fantastic to be on stage.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.